Why public-private partnerships are really not a good idea. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Good to be back with you again. Hoping to wrap up this discussion today. And if we don't, then we'll wrap it up tomorrow. I didn't really think we were going to get this much out of this subject, but
there's a lot to it. Well, it's a big subject, Chuck, and we've really only scratched the surface even in three programs.
Right.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about the idea of public-private partnership. That's when a government entity owns a piece of infrastructure or a facility or something that they see as capital in order to generate revenue to pay for all the things the government wants to pay for. So what they do is they go out and they bid at contracts for other entities, usually private companies, to handle the maintenance, upkeep, maybe the construction and design and building of a certain piece of infrastructure, whether it's a road or a bridge, or it's a government building or a parking garage, or as we talked about yesterday, even golf courses and public parks. And they use that so that they get an upfront payment from the private company in exchange for the company getting a long-term lease. And it can be the shortest one I've heard of so far is about 25 or 35 years. Longest one so far is, everybody remembers the lease of the Panama Canal, which was 99 years. So you can have a lot of leases of various lengths, but where the private entity, after they put the investment in, they get a recoup and get all the profits off of the thing, such as a toll road in Indiana, a $3 billion upfront investment by a conglomerate made up of Spain and Australia, now run the Indiana toll road, and they paid $3.8 billion upfront, but for the next 75 years, they get to collect all the tolls and keep the profits. And as we talked about earlier, when you have to look at future market conditions, we're talking about a report from the Buckeye Institute for Public Policy Solutions and the Reason Foundation, two libertarian leaning think tanks, making the case, trying to debunk myths and set forward facts, Chuck, on these transportation public-private partnerships. And as we talked about over the last couple of days, this is a little bit of cherry picking because, number one, they're only bringing up the myths and the facts that they can easily debunk. And number two, they start with transportation because it's harder to get the public to accede to or think of the government getting out of the business of running roads and bridges. But this is one of a number of papers, and we'll keep our eye open for the future papers, that is trying to set up the argument why it could be a very good thing for government and their economy and their budgets, best in public-private partnerships. Well, Chuck, again, like I said, that belies the fundamental idea that maybe government has overextended itself, and the reason why it has budget deficits is because it's doing too much. It's in too many areas. They're trying to run golf courses and parks and parking garages and other things, and that those are not legitimate areas for government to be involved in, that maybe the private sector should be the ones who are controlling, maintaining, and yes, even owning those type of infrastructures or those type of assets. Because when government owns them, as we've talked about before, they take them out of the tax base. So local governments are not recouping any kind of property taxes or use taxes for those government-owned lands. And the government then also has to use tax dollars to pay for the maintenance, upkeep, repair, improvements, etc. And so now, instead of government realizing we shouldn't be there in the first place, and we should let go of this, and we should divest in these areas, you know, why should government be the biggest real estate holder in a local community? They should divest and sell off to private entities and just maintain the basics that government needs to maintain. And obviously, Chuck, we talk about police, fire, yeah, sanitation, etc. And even some of those can be handled better by private entities. Look at volunteer fire departments. It used to be all over the area when we were a more rural society. But the whole point is, and getting down to it, is the Institute and Reason aren't asking the right question. Should government be involved and own this asset, resource, piece of property? Is it legitimate for government to own it, or should they divest and give it over to private hands, and then we'll go from there?
Let's talk about, just for a second, you brought up the example of Route 35, which you drive weekly and I drive occasionally, so I'm fully aware of what's going on down there, because I've been sitting here rubbing my hands together. When I go to Florida, I like to drive down 35 and catch 64 and then cut across to cut off the triangle there, going from Central Ohio down to 77. One of the problems that people are running into, of course they didn't want to pay an additional toll, because they're looking at it, when they buy gasoline, they pay road use taxes.
That's right.
So these poor farmers who are now going to be forced to pay a toll, and let's face it, you're not allowed to drive your tractor on Route 35.
You're not. No, that's right.
You're going to have to use Old 35 to do that, which is that 14-mile stretch is going to become Old 35.
They've renamed stretches where the new road's already in as 817. So what will happen is, if they ever get the middle section finished, then the roadbed, which is still 35, a two-lane roadbed, and my church sets right off that road, will become 817 and connect all the way through down to Winfield again.
And the problem here is, Barry, that the states, almost all of them, are not using their road use taxes for road use purposes.
Well, of course not. Of course not.
They're using them to plug revenue gaps. And instead of maintaining infrastructure like is what's supposed to be happening with the road use taxes, instead they're selling off the roads to private entities who then charge tolls. Well, right. Of course, the toll road was always a toll road. It's been a toll road since it was built. But there are mentions in this article about quote-unquote innovative new ways of doing interchanges like 36, 37, and 71. You're going to turn that over to a private entity and charge me a toll to get on and off Route 71 in Delaware? Is that how that's going to work? How are you going to do this? See, there are these nebulous instances where they talk about how we could do wonderful things here. What's it going to cost me? Because I'm already paying.
That's
now,
right.
I've argued in favor of private companies building roads. I have no problem with that whatsoever, if they can buy the right-of-ways and that kind of thing. But one of the mentions in this article, and myth number 7, governments give private companies the authority to take private property through eminent domain and transportation public-private partnership deals. Okay, again, a mischaracterization of the question. They come out and say that, no, these private entities are not given the power to do eminent domain. But the state maintains it. So if the private entity comes to the state and says, you know, we want to build a toll road there, we need the property, rather than going and paying the person what it's worth, they come to the state and they say, we need you to condemn that for us. And the state will do it.
And they have cover with the Kelo decision at the United States Supreme Court, the Kelo versus London decision, where it's okay for a government entity to take private property and then take it by eminent domain and then transfer it to an entity that will raise more taxes from it.
And that's the bottom line on Kelo, because the whole point was that in order for the taxing entity to make additional revenue, it was okay to steal property and turn it back over to the state, who then turns it over to a private entity for use. Now, I'm telling you right now that both Buckeye Institute and Reason should know better than this, because I know Buckeye Institute came out and wrote a white paper on Kelo, because I've read it years ago, because the Kelo decision was, what, 2005?
I believe so, yes.
Buckeye came out with a scathing report on Kelo. So this myth number 7, they know better than that.
Well, again, and they count this very carefully, Chuck, that this is a potential, and that they're just working around trying to think it out and just dispel some myths. But the big problem is that many of their myths could end up becoming reality depending upon the changes in the economy. What happens in Indiana? Let's take that example since we used it the other day. They've leased their turnpike for 75 years and they got $3.8 billion up front. Well, what happens in 10 or 20 years if they run into another budget shortfall because they become fiscally irresponsible again and they spend their way into a big hole, which seems to be the general cycle of most governments, because they've decided that they've got to meet everybody's needs. So therefore, they're going to get involved in so many other things and running this, that, and the other and buying up this piece of property and expanding here and there and yonder, taking it out of the tax base. And so their general revenues go down and all of a sudden they got this big hole again. Well, what happens if they say, we got this lease here with this company. Wouldn't it just be better if we just sold it to them, right? We could then monetize what they would get from the next 75 years and just have them pay it for us now, and we'll just get rid of it.
Well, there's another issue here, Barry. Let's talk about what is putting major holes in state budgets. And it's not necessarily all this stuff that we've talked about. What it is unfunded mandates from the federal government.
Well, that's a big part of it, yes.
Medicaid costs are absolutely driving state budget mavens insane, because all they can see is increases in costs and decreases in revenue. So these guys are looking for ways to handle this kind of thing, when the best thing that you could do is say, look, we have created a social quote-unquote safety net, which isn't a safety net at all. We have created this social safety net That is unsustainable. But nobody wants to admit that because they know that what's going to happen is you can't get reelected by talking about doing Medicaid reform. So we really don't have statesmen at the helm. We have people who like their job as a state legislator or a federal legislator, and they just, let's play status quo ante. Well, this is what it's getting us. Further and further and further in the hole. So we actually have libertarian think tanks who are coming up with ideas to help the state continue to raise revenue while they're selling off vital pieces of that revenue generation to private entities and then making up these, frankly, not particularly convincing arguments. If you think about them in any kind of rational fashion, you sit down and you look at them and say, is this really what the question is? Because he who frames the question wins the debate. Well, these guys are framing their own questions and answering them themselves and saying, look, wow, what a great job we did. We've answered all the objections to public-private partnership in managing transportation infrastructure. Not so fast. As we've pointed out, there are a number of holes in these myths that they have answered. For instance, I love this one, myth number 8, what government ends up holding the bag if a PPP project goes bankrupt. Holding what bag? They have the bag that they had before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly the point. But I was just looking at that one as you were talking, Chuck, and there's an interesting thing here. Let's say the consent air goes bankrupt. Well, but this report even admits goes back to the lender. In other words, you've got a bank or a banking company or a group of private equity lenders who now have the oversight of this project. And what they're going to do is they're going to go out and find another operator. They still hold the lease. The government still doesn't get anything out of it. And so if the bank negotiates a better deal with another entity because the term may be a little shorter or it's showing that it's bringing in lots of revenue, well, that's resources that if the state really did have control, they could utilize, but they don't get a chance to because they have turned over the actual control to the lender, which debunks another one of the myth debunkers in the Buckeye program that the state maintains and sometimes increases their control over these projects.
That's right. The bankruptcy trustee ends up in control of the lease.
That's right.
And that's usually the lender, which is a bank or an insurance company or whoever came up with the money to fund the thing. See, that's why this thing is so full of holes and so cherry-picked. I'm really glad we have someone who is a lobbyist and who understands some of these issues to deal with some of these things, Barry, because let's face it, you've seen the inside of the monster, and as ugly as it is, you can at least help us to explain how ugly it is on the inside, because some of us can see it from the outside, and we see it from the private sector end of it. I can see the private sector end of it. These look to me like, honestly, like sweetheart deals once again for the private section.
Well, in much sense, Chuck, it is. Now, I want to go into one other quick thing here because their ninth myth, they're kind of shooting at what we're talking about. The partnerships should be avoided because they commit future generations when policymakers today cannot predict what the needs will be. Well, they say that's myth, but then they roll out their facts. And so governments do this all the time. They make a lot of commitments for longer than 50 years, and they talked about changing public pension benefits. Well, yes, Chuck, and you see the government ran into a big problem, and that's part of what's driving these budget deficits are the fact that they made a lot of big promises early on and locked themselves in for years, and then when the cost came due, they didn't have the money for it. And that's what's driving a lot of your deficits is pension costs. But what they get into, it's entirely possible. I love how they cage this. It's entirely possible that changing circumstances will require revisions to an agreement, and that is why all concession agreements have detailed provisions to permit changes during their term. Okay, Chuck, ladies and gentlemen, think about this. If government runs into a problem and they have to make changes to the contracts, who is in the driver's seat in the negotiations? Is it the government or is it the leaseholder? Just putting it out there, ladies and gentlemen.
Yep.
But point is, we know who's in the driver's seat. So that means that if they have to come back and renegotiate the contracts, and mainly I think what's going to happen is the renegotiations are going to be because the government, well, you're raising more money even under our caps than we expected, and so we need a piece of that. Well, the concessionaire can really make a lot of things more amenable, more palatable to them, including control issues. Jack. Even in something like transportation infrastructure, public-private partnerships, although they look good at the surface and up front, they are fraught with major problems in the long term that governments probably should be better off just divesting of the infrastructure or of the facility rather than just trying to have a joint ownership.
And as a friend of ours on the radio always said, the devil's in the details. We are out of time. Join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.